There's essentially two broad narratives in terms of debate on the left over the course of the 20th century about the trajectory of modern or late capitalism. On the one hand, there's the argument of what you might call the orthodox Marxists, pioneered by Lenin Bakharin, that the late capitalism, monopoly capitalism, has an inbuilt tendency towards war and imperialism. The other rival interpretation was advanced by Karl Kautsky, known for what at one stage as the Pope of Marxism, a great authority in Marxism, who actually suggested at the outset of World War I, in fact, that rather than late capitalism, rather than monopoly capitalism having an inbuilt tendency to war, in fact, the tendency within advanced capitalism was actually towards the cessation of war, towards what he called ultra-imperialism. So this debate, which first sprung up, if you like, in the context of the First World War, has actually re-emerged in recent times in debates involving people like Hart and Negri and questions to do with globalisation and the anti-capitalist movement. But before I get on to that, I'm going to be discussing first up the traditional Marxist interpretation of Lenin and Bakharin about the nature of imperialism. I'm then going to be discussing how that actually panned out in what Eric Hobsbawm called the Long 30-Year War between 1914 and 1945. Then I'm going to be discussing whether or not Bakharin and Lenin's approach to imperialism actually held fast from the, if you like, the long post-war boom going into the period of neoliberalism. And then finally, probably in the 35th or 40th minute, I'm going to be discussing how all this has panned out in the 21st century with the two great historical moments of 9/11, the war on terror on the one hand, and the great world economic crisis which we're just entering into on the other. Okay, so that's the structure of the talk. So starting up then, first of all, with Lenin and Bakharin, the founding fathers, if you like, of the Marxist theory of imperialism. Their argument essentially was that certain inbuilt tendencies within capitalism led inevitably towards war. They picked out a series of features. They talked about the concentration of capital, with each firm getting larger over time. They talked also about the centralisation of capital, that as each company got larger, so it was able to use its size to crush its rivals, thereby monopolising, oligopolising any given sector of production into one, two or three companies at most. As companies get larger and larger, so the national borders become too narrow for their further growth. They have to break the narrow borders of the national economy to seize raw materials, to try and penetrate new markets, to access new supplies of labour and new investment outlets from the home nation. And so the third factor, as well as the concentration and centralisation of capital, is also the internationalisation of capital. As firms try to use their investment and their production to break national barriers and to establish world markets. This then takes us to the fourth feature of advanced capitalism that Lenin and Bakharin discussed, which is that as firms venture overseas, so more and more they drag their states in behind them to promote the affairs of capitalist enterprises and to protect the home market by means of high tariff walls. So the phrase that Lenin and Bakharin used to describe this kind of capitalism, which is clearly distinct from the 19th century, if you like, market capitalism, which had been described by people even in an ideal type, like Adam Smith and so forth, the move towards monopoly capitalism, they described as state capitalist trusts, involving states and monopoly capital becoming increasingly intertwined, with bank capital and industrial capital increasingly fusing together. And so we saw also that a further feature of this move towards state capitalist trusts was that trade wars increasingly become national events rather than the province of individual companies. And trade wars increasingly lead, Lenin and Bakharin argued, to shooting wars. Every commercial conflict, Bakharin writes, between the great powers is ultimately resolved only by reference to the balance of military forces. So the result then, the inbuilt tendency of capitalism, is a continual drive to war that's endemic in the system. And so Lenin and Bakharin use this analysis to explain the origins of the First World War. As the German capitalist class was ever going to break through its national borders and to develop world markets, it had to encounter the existing power of the British and French empires. The only way it could do that was by building up its military forces in order ultimately to smash the French and British spheres of influence. Thus, the First World War was the outgrowth of economic competition between the big state monopoly capitals of Britain, France, and Germany. That then was the guts of Lenin and Bukharin's theory of imperialism. In addition, there was a central feature which Lenin gave great weight to, which is the importance of imperialism as an outlet for excess capital. Lenin made a great point about a driving force for imperialism was the desire, particularly for British finance capital, to offload stocks of surplus capital that could not be invested profitably at home and to use foreign markets to reach a higher rate of profit overseas. So that, if you like, is in a synopsis, in a nutshell, the summary of the Marxist approach, a traditional Marxist approach to imperialism, its origins, its consequences. Lenin and Bukharin's books, their works, we have copies of them here, Imperialism, the Higher Stage of Capitalism, and Bukharin's Imperialism and World Economy, were actually written as a rejoinder to the work of Karl Kautsky. Kautsky had a very different approach to the nature of modern capitalism. He argued that rather than their leading to an imminent drive to war, in fact, late monopoly capitalism actually could pave the way for a state of permanent peace. That war, far from being a necessary feature of capitalist competition, was actually a barrier to its further development. Kautsky suggested that the trend towards monopolization would actually enhance the capacity of the monopolist to arrange a peaceful carve-up of the world market. Interdependence of trade and commerce would lead to the elimination of competition between the national groups. In other words, if you're a bit like a gang of, you know, a mafia, they can work out their various patches and have, a pact of non-competition in their areas of domination. So Kautsky called this the era of ultra-imperialism, from the Latin word ultra meaning beyond. In other words, the capacity of monopoly capitalism to go beyond the phase of imperialism. That the First World War was simply a result of, he argued, the dominance of areas of finance capital, shipping capital, and various others who had an interest in war. Now, it has to be said that in terms of predicting the future course of 20th century history, Lenin and Bukharin have far more to offer us than Kautsky. Here's what Bukharin wrote in 1915. Once the present war is over, new problems will have to be solved by the sword. Partial agreements are, of course, possible here and there. Every agreement or fusion, however, will only reproduce a bloody struggle on a new scale. The period of an idyllic, peaceful existence has sunk into oblivion. Capitalist society is today whirling in the mad hurricane of world wars. So this is very much proven, I think, by the course of history between 1918 and 1945. Attempts by the rising powers, the United States, Germany, Japan, Soviet Union, to carve out their own spheres of influence came smack up against the existing dominant powers of Britain and France. And furthermore, with the efforts by each national government to resolve the crisis of the Great Depression to their own advantage, these conflicts between the rising and declining powers soon broke out into all-out war in 1939. So far from peaceful development and ultra-imperialism being the order of the day, the period through to and including World War II was in fact one of fresh barbarism. Underpinning the drive to war, just as Lenin and Bukharin argued, was a further development of state monopoly capitalism, most acutely and obviously in the case of the Soviet Union, but also too in the case of Germany and Japan. Now, that, if you like, is a summary of the, I guess, the traditional analysis of imperialism. Now, a series of phenomena, developments, from 1945 onwards began to cast some doubt on this traditional perspective. Number one, the large colonial holdings of the British, the French, the Dutch, the Spanish empires and so forth have by and large vanished. There are relatively few areas in the world that are ruled in a direct colonial relationship with an imperial power. This is a result, obviously, of the anti-colonial movements of the 1930s, 40s and 50s. It's a result of the rise of the United States and its basically ordering the British and the French effectively to withdraw from their imperial empires. It's also the result of the rise of substitute products, enabling manufacturing to supply for plantation industry, which, for example, kept countries like Malaya and Vietnam in the thrall of the British and French empires. The one exception to the idea of imperial states, established, if you like, in the countries of the global south, or what used to be called the Third World, would be Israel, of course, such as the significance of oil, such as the significance of the control of oil to US hegemony around the world, that in fact Israel was established as a fresh colonial settler state in 1947. But Israel aside, by and large, we've seen the death knell of direct colonial rule. A second area where clearly Lenin Bukharin's, or Lenin especially, his interpretation of imperialism began to be thrown into doubt was the centrality of capital exports to the colonies of the Third World, the Global South. Now, this was even in doubt actually at the time that Lenin himself was writing. In fact, you'd have to say that the centrality of capital exports, particularly from Britain with its dominant finance capital and banking system, was actually only really a phenomenon of the late 19th century. Even by 1914, even in the case of Britain, direct capital exports to the Third World had begun to retract. And certainly, when you look at the world today, in fact, the vast majority, 80% of all foreign investment, goes between and within the advanced OECD member states. The exception, of course, is China, which is the single greatest destination, in fact, of foreign investment. But outside China, in fact, when you look at the top 20 recipients of foreign investment, 17 of them are advanced OECD member states, that is, powerful Western economies. The exceptions being China, Mexico, and Brazil. And even there, you have to say to what degree they're outside the OECD. A third area where I guess you could say some doubt can be cast on some of the predictions or the features of imperialism described by Lenin and Bukharin is the issue of trade wars and tariffs. Now, this is certainly true in the 1890s and 1900s and became true again in the 1930s. But from the 1950s onwards, we began to see a gradual winding back of tariffs to manufacturing goods. Even though very little progress was made in the area of agriculture and services, there were general phenomena in the area of manufacturing, particularly in the 50s, 60s and 70s, was actually to a steadfast, steady reduction in tariffs on manufacturing goods. Further, rather than being a direct state ownership of increasing portions of the private sector, which did seem to be a phenomenon of the 30s, let's say through to the 60s, from the 1980s and 1990s, the neoliberal revolution with associated privatisation actually led to winding back of direct state ownership of large chunks of Western industry. The proportion of industry in state hands within the OECD, for example, halved between the mid-80s and the late 90s. Furthermore, the jostling of rival imperial powers, which has never stopped, has not led to a Third World War. So, if you like, we had the two great bloody conflagrations of 1914 and 1939. Well, we've now had a period of 64 years where there has been no direct military clash between the major military superpowers. A couple of factors, I think, stand out as explanations for this. One is clearly the threat of nuclear annihilation. The mutually assured destruction, MAD, played a role in keeping the United States and the Soviet Union at arm's length in terms of their direct engagement over, for example, Berlin or divided Germany. You know, in the 1970s, we were regaled with stories about Russian tanks, you know, heading westwards across, you know, Germany, to seize West Germany and so forth. We didn't see the nuclear holocaust that could have been. Partly, I suspect, it was a rational calculation of the two superpowers that neither of them were going to survive such an exchange. This did not mean, however, that the two sides did not come into military conflict. If you like to use the management terminology, they outsourced it. They outsourced it to Indochina, they outsourced it to Southern Africa, they outsourced it to the Horn of Africa, they outsourced it to Central America. But the two great superpowers did not directly come face to face. The other factor, I think, that explains why no World War III is that the sheer hegemony of the United States within Western Europe meant that there was no fresh breakout of conflict between Britain and Germany and France. Basically, the ruling classes of each country made a calculation their interests are best served, ultimately, within the broader European Union project, within the general military umbrella of the United States. And so a rising tide lifted all boats in the context of the post-war boom. The British, the German and the French capitalist classes were each able to prosper without seizing markets and seizing territory from their hitherto historical rivals. And when faced with competition from the Soviet Union, each benefited from the fact that they had to spend relatively little in the way of military hardware to protect their territory, given they, if you like, hid under the skirts of NATO and the US nuclear weaponry for fear of being gobbled up by the Soviet wolf. Now, One reaction to these developments, the end of colonial possessions, the loss of capital exports as a significant factor underpinning the Western economies, the neoliberal privatization push, the absence of the Third World War, led in the 1990s to what you might call neo-Kautskyism, or neo-Kautskyism, the idea that perhaps capitalism could once again see its way past the stage of military conflict between the imperial powers. That in fact, war was increasingly, as Kautsky predicted, according to his theories, an illogical phenomenon from the point of view of the capitalist class. So writers Hart and Negri wrote in their book Empire that wars and conflicts between national states are essentially a relic of the past, illogical from the point of view of the emerging international capitalist class, with which its investments flung far and wide, could not really care, well, which broke off their links with particular nation states and cared not whether they're headquartered in Berlin, in San Francisco, or Beijing. So like Kautsky, Hart writes, business leaders around the globe recognize imperialism is bad for business because it sets up barriers that hurt global flows. It's not just the left wing, like Hart and Negri, that we hear these arguments from. Also Thomas Friedman, the author of The Lexus and the Olive Branch, a right-wing columnist in the American media. Friedman argued that no two countries and McDonald's have ever gone to war with each other. Now, apart from being factually incorrect when you look at the case of Yugoslavia in 1999, his argument essentially is that countries and McDonald's are clearly engaging in worldwide flows of trade and investment. Countries engaged in such flows, which don't seek to hide themselves behind national barriers, will find sufficient international common interest to avoid a reversion to war and empire. So in other words, neo-Kautskyism's feature is essentially that war and imperialism are the actions of dysfunctional state regimes rather than something embedded in the wider dynamic system of capitalism. Now we have to say, in short, this is bunk. Although state monopoly capitalism certainly changed in form in particular periods in the latter half of the 20th century, it has not disappeared as an historic stage of advanced capitalism. The capital is still massively associated with particular national states, which are integrally involved in the affairs of big business headquartered in their home territory. So despite all the talk about globalization and footloose capital, it's still very much the case. All, 90% of the world's multinationals are headquartered in about four or five countries. United States, Japan, Britain, France, Germany, Switzerland, and maybe one or two others. So we still see an overwhelming domination of headquarters in particular countries, and those headquarters develop strong relations with national states. We can look at the issues of the subsidies, the building up of infrastructure, the direct military orders that keeps companies like McDonnell Douglas, General Motors afloat, the ports and roads being constructed by national and local governments, the repression of the working class with anti-union laws, representation of bodies like the World Trade Organization, the IMF and the World Bank. In fact, the World Trade Organization, I think, demonstrates quite well how the internationalization of capital that we've seen over the last century actually requires greater and greater involvement by states and governments in the affairs of their multinationals. We see the preferential defense contracts, the handling of international debt, the manipulation of exchange rates, the protection of intellectual copyrights. All these things are handled not by armies belonging to General Motors or Chrysler or IBM, but are handled by the US State Department and the Pentagon or the European Union. Even in the heyday of neoliberalism, the idea that the state and the market would increasingly be set adrift, the state no longer had much involvement in the affairs of the market, was complete rot as well. We can see this with the Chrysler bailout in 1979, when the Carter government basically stepped in to stop Chrysler from going bankrupt. We can see the bailout of the savings and loans companies in the 1980s, illustrative of the fact that as capital got larger, each block became, if you like, too large to let fail. That the consequences of the unwinding of big companies, like in 1979 Chrysler, the savings and loans companies, in other words, the building societies, the knock-on effects of the whole economy were so great that individual states could not let these companies go bust and therefore stepped in to save them. State spending as a proportion of GDP was actually stable, if not rising, during the heyday of neoliberalism, and is vastly higher than it was in 1929. So, for example, Chris Harman cites a figure that federal government spending by the United States government as a proportion of GDP in the United States was 2.5% in 1929 on the eve of the Wall Street crash, but was 20%, eight times higher, in 2007. So we've had all these years of globalization, free market economics, deregulation, privatization, but actually the US federal government plays far more of a role now than it did, let's say, 50 or 70 years ago. The same is true of the military. We've seen military spending drop fairly dramatically in relation to the heyday of World War II and the Korean War. At one stage in World War II, military spending accounted for something like 45% of US GDP. It's now down to about 5%. So there has been, if you like, a withdrawal of the state in relation to armed expenditure. But when you compare that with the historic trend, before 1939, when US military expenditure was only 1% or less of GDP. So there's certain fluctuations and variations, but any idea that the state is stepping back, any idea that globalization is giving rise to a new period of peace, I think is debunked by those figures. The state, even in the heyday of neoliberalism and deregulation in the early 2000s, was never going to simply stroll off the stage of world imperialism. Now, I think that Hart and Negri enjoyed a certain popularity in the late 1990s and early 2000s. I think it's no accident they've gone rather quiet lately, because the two world historic events of the 21st century, I think, have well and truly smashed any idea of neo-Kautskyism, any idea that the further development of world capitalism could actually usher in a period of peace and peaceful competition. Those two events, of course, being 9/11 and the war on terror on the one hand, and the world economic crisis on the other. I'd suggest, if anything, these two events actually tend to confirm the validity of Bakharin and Lenin's series of imperialism, albeit having made some of the qualifications I made earlier. The Marxist theory of imperialism, the theories of Lenin and Bakharin, are ideally equipped, in fact, to explain what is going on here. If you think of what the essence of Lenin and Bakharin's argument was about the nature of imperialism, essentially that the different national economies grew and contracted at faster or lesser paces. There were some rising powers and there were some declining powers. But the rise and fall of individual powers could never be achieved peacefully. It wasn't the case that, like, I don't know, marathon runners, you know, you just let the other faster foot guy pass you by and say, oh, good luck. This doesn't happen when it comes to world imperialism. Now, the power that's in relative decline goes to its utmost to try, to extend our analogy, trip the person up, edge them, you know, elbow them in ribs, whatever, throw pepper in their face, whatever, to try and stop them overtaking. And in microcosm, that's what we're seeing today with the war on terror. The rise and decline of the great powers can never be achieved purely peacefully. So if we think about the big picture of US hegemony now compared to what it was, let's say, in the 50s, clearly, and I come on to talk about some of the qualifications, you'd have to say it is a weaker power relative to its rivals than it was in its heyday in the 1950s, when basically what the United States said went. Okay? That period is now over. But the United States saw a window of opportunity during the 1990s with a series of phenomena. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the stagnation of the Japanese economy, the fact that the European Union was still comprised 15 and 24 and 27 squabbling states that had not got round to organising their own national army. And the fact that China was coming up on the inside track, extend our marathon analogy, but was still nowhere capable of challenging US power. So the whole project for a new American century, the neocon idea, wasn't just a bunch of crazed cellar dwellers, you know, working out some plan to take over the world. It was actually quite a rational reaction to that window of opportunity that the United States enjoyed in the early part of the 2000s. And, of course, 9/11 served as a wonderful pretext for putting their plan into action. The aim of the war on terror was essentially to leverage the one thing in which the United States was unchallengeably supreme, if there's such a phrase, in which it was totally hegemonic, that is, its military power, to use that military power as a way of establishing its writ in a central area of world resources, that is, Central Asia and the Middle East. And to use its military control over that region as a way of, as I say, leveraging diplomatic power, political power, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank, and so forth, to try to consolidate the temporary edge that it managed to achieve by the late 1990s. Now, of course, as we all know here, this idea of using its military power to reassert its hegemony has actually fallen to bits. That the resistance in Iraq, the ongoing quagmire in Afghanistan, have actually demonstrated not the hegemony of the United States power, but actually the limitations of the United States power. And I think that was demonstrated quite clearly with the latest NATO summit, whereby despite all the begging and pleading of Obama and so forth, Bush before him, the other NATO members offered to cough up the grand sum of 5,000 more troops to Afghanistan, illustrating the United States is no longer in the capacity to essentially, to leverage its military power to force its rivals to cough up for the greater good. Now, having said that, it's also the case we can see then that there are limits to this process, that militarily, despite the setbacks the United States has suffered in the Middle East, it is still overwhelmingly the military dominant power. It still spends 45% of world military spending. It still has 737 military bases, including military bases in two of its potential rivals, Germany and Japan, for which it actually gets paid to maintain the base, which tells you something about United States power. That actually Germany and Japan helped to pay for the cost of US bases in their own country. So that actually tells you something about US power. That the United States is no conceivable military threat for the time being. Now, having said that, of course, this fact is not fixed in concrete. And so we saw just recently some jostling in the South China Sea when a US spy ship was sent there to basically work out military installations and so forth, being challenged by detachments of the Chinese Navy. The Chinese are keen to build up their Navy to try to challenge US power in the Asian region. So, even if World War III is not imminent, we can see the competition between the great powers economically and a shifting balance of economic advantage underpins military tensions that prepare the ground for war. This may not be leading to a direct military confrontation between China and the United States or between the United States and the European Union, but nonetheless is leading to outbreaks of war that are bloody and murderous for all that. The other phenomenon I think that tends to validate the conventional Marxist explanation of imperialism is, of course, a world economic crisis. I think if we look at that, two important aspects. One is the tendency towards fusion between state and capital, the intertwining of state and capital, Bakharin described in great detail. The collapse of world trade, the banking system, is leading to a return of the state with a vengeance. The neoliberal project, which rhetorically at least, even though not much in fact, rhetorically at least, was about market forces, has given way to a promotion. The only thing, in fact, that can save the world economy is state intervention and more of it. So in the United States, we've seen trillions of dollars spent on the stimulus packages, the bailouts, the bank rescue packages. The United States government is spending 80% of its GDP, or committing 80% of its GDP, to bailing out the banks. Effective nationalisation in many cases. And where the United States is led, the European Union, Japan and China have followed. We also see increasing tension between the imperialists that Bakharin suggested would occur. You can look at this in terms of protectionism, which went into abeyance for a long period of time, but we now see returning with a vengeance. The often quoted figure, 17 of the top G20 nations, in fact implemented some form of protectionism between September last year and February or March this year. The subsidies to the various car industries, Obama's, or rather Congress's, Buy American provision in the US stimulus package. The United States has banned long-haul Mexican trucks from the interstate highway system of the United States. The Indian government has slapped a ban on imports of toys from China. Russia has raised tariffs on cars. China has banned Coca-Cola from buying a Chinese soft drink company. These are all examples, if you like, of those trade wars, even if not in full flight. Nonetheless, you know, examples of spot fires breaking out here and there, which the future, I guess, will tell us if they develop into something greater. In particular, the G20 summit and the economic crisis has laid bare the tensions and the contradictions in the US-China relationship. The United States always tries to get out of its crisis by offloading the pain onto other rival national states. So in 1971, Nixon unilaterally broke up the Bretton Woods system and floated the US dollar, stoking inflation, using money to pay for the Vietnam War, essentially offsetting the cost of the US crisis onto its trading partners. In 1985, with its Plaza Accord, the United States basically forced the Japanese government to allow the yen to rise and the US dollar to fall in order to restore US competitiveness, and also to snap voluntary restraints on the exports of Japanese cars to the US market. Now, however, the US no longer has the capacity to write the rules underpinning the world trade system. The United States has gone from being the world's largest surplus country to the world's largest debtor. Its banking and financial system are held responsible for bringing on the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression. It now faces China, a rival power that it did so much to stimulate its growth as a potential rival to Japan and East Asia, is now facing China as a potential threat, albeit still some way behind economically, but nonetheless the single largest holder of US Treasury bonds. The US may still be the largest economy in the world, have no doubt about that. The US economy is three times larger than the next rival, Japan. So its GDP, I believe, is about $14 trillion, whereas the GDP of Japan is a mere $4.5 trillion. So the US is still overwhelmingly the dominant power economically, but you'd have to argue that its edge has receded compared to its rivals. And you can tell this with some of the statements and discussion going on around the G20 summit. Here's something from the New York Times on the 28th of March. In the past, American officials travelled to India, Brazil, China, and South Africa and lectured government officials on the need for open markets, free trade, and deregulation. But now, some of those very policies, particularly deregulation, are viewed as the culprits of the recent economic collapse. Kenneth Rogoff, a Harvard and former IMF economist, told the New York Times, "The US brand name has clearly suffered from this crisis, and the rest of the world is no longer willing to sit quietly and be lectured by the United States on how they should conduct economic policy." And those facts underpin the paralysis at the G20 summit. Whereas the United States was able to prevent Germany and France from setting up a mechanism to regulate US banks, but at the same time, it was not able to get a commitment by the European Union to engage in another round of stimulus packages. Indeed, the European Union president described the United States program of basically inflationary debt spending as the road to hell, illustrating something of the tensions between the EU and the United States. The United States is trying to maintain the role of the US dollar as reserve currency, which is effectively like playing Monopoly with a permanent get-out-of-jail card in your pocket, because it enables you maybe a kind of, pass go and collect $200 every time, because the US dollar as a reserve currency effectively allows the United States capitalist class to keep running huge debt and get the rest of the world to pay for it. China has basically, rather softly, begun to blow the whistle on this. Now, of course, there's a kind of a mutually assured financial destruction going on here, which is that China can't actually pull out of the US dollar as a reserve currency, because to do so would see a collapse of the US dollar and with it the value of its huge holdings of US government debt. Nonetheless, it does hold that card in its pocket, and it does have the potential to play it if the crisis gets far worse. What have they got to lose at some stage if the US dollar falls and keeps falling? The fact is that the US is now as dependent on China as China is on it, and China is now trying to use that greater economic leverage for more political clout on the world stage, to get more votes, for example, at the International Monetary Fund. So just to draw to a close. At the G20 summit, host British Prime Minister Gordon Brown declared, "A new world order," remember that phrase? Just as farcical as the last one. "A new world order is emerging with the foundation of a new progressive era of international cooperation. I hope that this talk has demonstrated that the very conception is absurd. All the basic underpinnings of world trade over the past 60 years, the domination of the US dollar, the unchallenged supremacy of the United States economic and financial power are crumbling, and this crisis is bringing out more into the opening and sharpening the underlying antagonisms between the great powers. Far from having set the world economy back on track, the G20 summit in fact only demonstrated the very contradictions spelled out by Lenin and Bukharin 80 years ago. Notably, the contradiction between a globally integrated economy on the one hand and the national state system on the other. and further, the impossibility of the rival national states adopting a genuinely international approach to resolving the currency. The United States may still be what is sometimes called the indispensable power in the world system, but its rivals are snapping at its heels. They are too weak to impose an alternative set of world trading rules and military balance of power, but they are strong enough to stop the United States getting its own way unchallenged. The growing integration of trade and finance as part of a tendency of world economy described by Bukhara 95 years ago has not made for a stable world order. And if you don't believe this, listen to Ban Ki-moon, not someone I'd normally advise people listen to. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, and usually regarded as a toady for the Americans. This is what he said just a couple of weeks ago. In good times, economic and social development comes slowly. In bad times, things fall apart alarmingly fast. It is a short step from hunger to starvation, from disease to death, from peace and stability to conflict and wars that spill across borders and affect us all near and far. Unless we can build a worldwide recovery, we face a looming catastrophe in human development. So I think the fact this comes from, you know, someone who's not known for wild statements, someone who's normally known for kind of easy does it, kind of pro-American, moderate speeches, basically to reinforce the American power on the world stage, is actually spelling out effectively, in other forms of words, what Luxembourg argued a few decades ago. That basically capitalism faces, or the world faces a choice between barbarism or socialism, between a world in which world trading wars may actually eventuate into world military wars, in which the kind of wars we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq will be but a mere prelude to a greater bloody conflagration. So I would recommend that comrades read Lenin's Imperialism, a High Stage of Capitalism, Bukharin's Imperialism, a World Economy, because I still believe, albeit the qualifications I've made in this talk, they still offer an unparalleled guide to the future of the world, and also the necessity of throwing this juggernaut of world capitalism off its tracks and replacing it with a socialist world where you really can have a new world order of global cooperation and development based around production of human need, not on the basis of accumulation of profit in the hands of the few.